Welcome back. This is Happenings Q&A, and I'm Frank Carmichael. Well, periodically, you'll find Billy Joel's name in the news. We hear about him wrapping his automobile around a tree or checking himself into rehab. Or more recently, Elton John voicing his frustrations over Joel's unwillingness to deal with his alcoholism and take his music career seriously. Joel has lamented publicly over his inability to find a lifetime soulmate. So just what makes Billy Joel tick? In what Publisher Weekly calls surprisingly intimate, author Hank Bordowitz has given readers and fans the definitive biography. That would be Billy Joel, The Life and Times of an Angry Man. Hank joins us today with a very candid and insightful look at Joel's unpredictable life and career. Good afternoon and welcome, Hank.
Thank you, Frank. Good afternoon to you.
You know, I would like to add to that that you have a 30-year career in the music business. You've worked as a radio and recording studio engineer, producer, musician, record retailer, distributor, recording artist, trade journalist, record promotion, publicity, and A&R consultant, radio programmer. You know what? I could go on, but I want to ask you about this book. But, wow, what a storied career you've had.
Yeah, and I've almost lived to tell about it. Survival in the music business is not what it was cracked up to be.
You know, I'm hopeful that after we visit with you about the book, you could tell me just what has happened to the record industry. I hope we have a few minutes for that as well.
Oh, I have another book about that, actually. So, yeah, I'd love
okay,
to talk
well,
about
then,
that.
Then you're well-versed on it.
Oh, yeah.
So now, I'm just curious, what were your thoughts when you first heard that Billy Joel was backing off on his autobiography?
I opened up a bottle of champagne.
Because yours stands as the preeminent book, doesn't it?
Because I think mine's the only one still in print. My buddy Mark Beagle, has a book. And we kind of exchanged notes because we run around in the same circles sometimes. But I don't think his book is still in print. He had a lot of problems with his publisher. But, you know, we just came out with a second edition, and it's new and improved and brings us pretty much up to date.
Yeah, that it does. But when you heard about that, after reading your book, I think I kind of understand why he did not, follow through on what was supposed to be his memoir. I mean, he received a $2 million advance for it, didn't he?
$3 million advance.
$3 million, I stand corrected.
So, I have orthopedic shoes, too.
So, is it one of those things where he's just not comfortable in his own skin to reveal such intimate details about his life? Or?
I think that has a great deal to do with it. That's also, I think, has to do a lot with why he drinks.
Well, I think that some of those very insightful pages are at the very beginning when you talk about his early childhood. Those days in Levittown and his father leaving the family.
Well, that's the root of it all, I think. You know, I've already Rip has something great to say towards the end of the book, which is, your father abandoned you and now you just want to piss on everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So,
growing up in a household with women, there wasn't a positive male influence there. I don't want to get into too great a detail, but his father worked for GE and took a position in Germany, basically.
Austria, yeah.
Yes, Austria, I'm sorry. And that was it, turned his back on the family. But you do say he did send money, right?
He sent money, some. Mm-hmm. He sent, occasionally birthday gifts, but he was raised. I mean, he spent his first, 14 years in Germany before World War II, and Germany was just not a healthy place for Jews during World War II.
No.
Especially not where he was. They lived, right in the center of it all.
Right.
And they were the number two manufacturer of cloth. There in Germany. And so he grew up in this very wealthy family in Germany. And suddenly, he's traveling around the world, winds up first in Cuba and then in the Bronx. And he felt you know, now that he was an adult, he wanted to go back to some place that was more genteel than America in the late 40s.
But couldn't he have done that with his family? I mean, I realize
I don't know that Roz wanted to go.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Joel's mother, Rosalyn. Had her children baptized as in an evangelical church when Billy was 12. And if I may just read this, it says here that one day the evangelical preacher got up to sermonize. He held up a dollar note and proclaimed, "This is the flag of the Jews." It strikes me as shocking that they would even be in that church.
Well, apparently they didn't know of this particular opinion of the guy. They were searchers. I mean, Roslyn was brought up by a couple of, very bohemian people. They were what are called secular Jews. They never went to, shul or anything like that. And, so she was trying to find some meaning in everything at that point.
So they did, basically, they were sucker punched. They're sitting in the pews. The minister, the preacher, gets up and says that, takes the wind out of them. And as you do say in the book, you mentioned that they left church and never came back.
Yeah. Yep. I don't think they ever went back to any church after that.
So what was it like growing up in Levittown?
Well, Levittown was very much the first working class suburb in America.
For all those returning GIs.
Yep. And it's still out there. I mean, you can find, if you go to his old neighborhood in Hicksville, all the houses are pretty much the same. Some people have added to them, either upwards or outwards. But for the most part, there are still these, little five-room houses. And, it's all made out of ticky-tacky, and it all looks just the same. And, this was the beginning of that. And it appealed to Helmut Joel a lot more than living in the Bronx did.
Now, what I found kind of interesting was that Billy kind of belonged to a gang, but it wouldn't be the kind of gang that we would think of today.
Well, no. They didn't wear colors and stuff like that. They were just basically, it was a male bonding thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, more of the West Side Story kind of gang, except that it was the suburban, version of it.
Right. And then in 1960...
And they didn't dance.
Right. In 1966, when he turned 18, it was time for he to go register like every other male in America. And you say in the book that that he pretty much proclaimed that he was his mother's sole support.
And at that point, he pretty much was.
Mm-hmm.
And he's always felt kind of guilty about that. And it's Billy Joel has ambiguous feelings about a lot of things.
Yeah, so he was conflicted about that because he lived in a community that was primarily populated with World War II vets.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the kids volunteered to go off to Vietnam.
If anything, it just really struck me how complex Billy Joel is and how conflicted he is. Time and time again, you point this out. And I'm just curious, how did you manage to get access to some of these people? Was it difficult to secure their cooperation?
Oh, Lord, yes.
I mean, I would think that a lot of them, Hank would get back to Billy and say, "Hey, Billy, I'm Hank Bordowitz has been calling me. Should I return the call?"
Well, actually, that happened.
Mm-hmm.
As you mentioned at the head of the interview here, and I'm glad you did, because now I don't have to clarify that, I spent some time in the recording studios in my youth, and one of the people I talked to about that was Phil Ramone. He ran the Hit Factory.
Yes.
Down on 52nd Street, Manhattan. And Phil and I, he didn't hire me, but we kept running into each other. We became friendly. And the first person I called when I signed the contract was Phil Ramone. I have his phone number, and talked to him. I said, "Phil, just signed contract to do a book on Billy Joel. You're the first person I've called, right after I signed it, stamped it, put it in the mail, and I went on the phone with you." And I want to set up a time where we can talk.
What was his response?
And his response was, well, I'll have to ask Billy. And I said, sure, go ask Billy. You know, he should know I'm doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And a week later, I called Phil back, and I said, have you spoken to Billy? And he said, yeah. And not only can't I do it, but you're going to have a time finding people who will talk to you. And in truth, that happened. My wife at that time worked for a company that made cabling. And one of their clients was Billy Joel's keyboard guy.
Hmm.
And the vice president of the company assured me up and down, gave me his number, said, call him, tell him I told you to call, and he'll talk to you. And I called him. Actually, I sent him an email to arrange a time to call, and he freaked out completely. You know, said, how did you get this number? How did you get this email address? I'm going to have to change my email, my phone number, because you're going to hound me to death. I can't talk to you. You know I can't talk to you. And I said, well, I knew it, but, you know, the guy assured me up and down that you would talk, and I'm not going to bother you again. I'm not here to harass you.
So the word was out on the grapevine, right, that you were writing this book, and people had a heads up that you might be contacting them. So how did you do it? Did you just literally wear some of these people down? Or?
Well, actually, I talked. The people I talked to, for the most part, were people I've known almost as long as they've known Billy.
Okay, so you drew on
Howard
your own
Bloom.
Personal resources, the people.
Yeah, Howard Bloom, I've known for eons.
Really?
And, you know, he's just a remarkable guy. And, you know, Elaine Schock, too. And she had some great stories. Artie Ripp is beholden to no one.
No.
Elliot Mazur is, you know, happy to talk about Billy as he is to talk about anything. Likes getting his name in print.
So,
you know, the people I talked to, were, you know, people who weren't really beholden to him anymore.
Right, right. These are people, independent-minded people that had strong careers of their own, and they weren't beholden to Billy.
Right, and the thing is that, you know, even Artie Ripp had very, very few. You know, this is a guy that Billy has maligned for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime anyone wants to talk about it, he will rip into Artie Ripp. But Artie had not a bad thing to say. Hardly had a bad thing to say about him. People who have worked with Billy are fiercely, fiercely loyal. I mean, Elaine told me any number of times how odd it felt, you know, talking about him like this.
Well,
you know, he inspires loyalty in the people mm-hmm. he works with.
And is that because he's generous to them with time and money, or?
Well, not if you ask Liberty DeVito, but that's a special case.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, honestly. I mean, I couldn't really tell you. It could be the money. It could be, you know, just his personality. It could be his devotion to the music. Mm-hmm.
Well, I have to be honest with you, Hank. Reading this book, I marveled at how much information you were able to get. And now I understand how you were able to secure it. Speaking of Artie Ripp, you know, I found it fascinating with when Joel was faced with this decision. I mean, he had two major labels, Columbia and Atlantic, wanting to sign him. Could you share with our listeners how that all played out and why he ended up with Columbia?
Well, yeah, sure. Atlantic wanted to sign him, and Atlantic was the hippest label at that time. You know, they had all the hip artists. They had Led Zeppelin. They had, you know, Ray Charles. Everyone who worked with Atlantic was just very cool. Columbia was the album, was the label that had, you know, history, and, you know, they had Benny Goodman, and they had Bob Dylan. They were a legacy label. And he got basically the same deal offered to him by both labels, and both company presidents talked to him. And Clive Davis was probably the most convincing. Clive often is.
But you know what, Hank? You also mention in your book that there's this one individual, Elizabeth Weber Small, that had some influence on this decision as well.
Oh, yes.
What a fascinating lady she is.
Still. And she's still gorgeous, by the way.
I see. I saw the photos in your book, yes. But she was, I mean, Billy really trusted her, right? I mean, this...
Yeah, he absolutely did. And, I mean, it was from the beginning a very strange relationship.
I think so.
I mean, you know, he replaced her brother
in the band.
He took her away from the drummer in his band.
Right.
You know, she was married to the drummer in his band.
Right. With a child.
Yeah, with a child. And Sean is still out in Nashville with, you know, working with his dad.
Mm-hmm. But Elizabeth.
And she was bright. She's very, very intelligent. I mean, I can't see Billy spending any significant amount of time with an unintelligent person, because Billy's a very smart guy.
Mm-hmm. But you know what? Do you think, I mean, and this is purely speculation, all right?
Okay.
What do you think Billy's life would be like today if he had stayed with Elizabeth? And maybe it's an unfair question.
It's more like if Elizabeth had stayed with him.
Right. Yes.
I don't know, because part of the problem, the reason she left, was that she was just getting tired of the whole rock and roll lifestyle thing. And at that juncture, it was just after The Stranger, Billy was finally gearing up to it.
Mm-hmm.
He had gone from, you know, this middleweight popular music guy to a certifiable rock star. You know, The Stranger. And
right.
So he was finally hitting his stride. And she got him there. And, you know, the whole thing just seemed empty to her.
See, I just, maybe I'm reading into the book more than I should have, but I find it, if I haven't already told you, I think you did a great job. I find this to be a fascinating book. But I think she could have given him more balance. I mean, he's gone through life saying that, you know, he doesn't have that lifetime soulmate. And I just wonder if it would have been her.
Could have been.
Because there would have been balance. I think there would have been more balance.
I think it would more likely have been Christie Brinkley.
Okay. Let's talk about that for a while. Christie Brinkley. I mean, this was the victim here. Was that Christie? Was she the victim because Billy just seems to have a wandering eye?
There's that. And there's also, she didn't approve of his chemical choices.
But you say in the book that that there were rumors that had circulated that Billy wasn't the only one with a roving eye.
Well, yeah, and you know she was with another guy pretty soon.
Right.
There were all sorts of rumors at that time. They were people just didn't understand them as a couple.
That it was just kind of an odd pairing?
Yeah, but the truth of the matter was, I mean, you see how they are today. I could actually see them at some juncture getting married again.
Well, they've got that common bond. I think
they're growing old together.
Right. They both have a common bond. They intensely love their daughter, don't they?
Well, they intensely love their daughter, but they're also very fond of each other. And it shows.
Mm-hmm.
And it's matured actually over the last, you know, since Katie Lee left.
You know, it's I find it interesting that she kind of said, didn't she, in your book that this was kind of a rebound for her, that Taubman, that was such a rush thing,
mm-hmm.
and that she was, and I'm taking this from memory, but something about. That it was like almost like coming off of the marriage with Billy was like post-traumatic syndrome, right?
Have you ever been on tour with a rock and roll band?
You know, actually, I filled in as a road manager for a few weeks for a band that had one hit. But it's a crazy. It's like a circus. It's like a sideshow.
What did it feel like when you got off the road?
Well, it's your life comes back. You know, you're back to putting, you know, it's putting your pants on like everyone else, and it's a whole different experience. I mean, you're back to a normal life.
Now imagine doing that 200 nights a year for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, it's just it would be almost surreal to me. I mean, it just seems as though the
post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard of lesser causes.
Right, but you know, Christy had to know what she was getting into. It wasn't like she hooked up with Billy Joel when he was an unknown entity. I mean, she had to have an idea of what was in store for her.
Until you've experienced it, you really can't know the intensity of it.
I guess that that could be the case, yes.
You know, the point was that he was trying very, very hard to balance, you know, having a family with, you know, being on the road as often as he was. And I, you know, I love the fact, you know, Elaine tells great stories about that time because her kid was with them too. Mm-hmm. They had a nursery backstage. And,
but,
you know, but it was very intense.
Yeah. And you're talking about two very career-driven people. And obviously, you know, they're both in pursuit of their careers that doesn't allow them a lot of time together. And and I guess, what is it? What is it, Hank? Is it absence makes the heart grow fonder or out of sight, out of mind? Take your pick, right?
Probably a little bit of both.
Yeah.
Nothing is quite that absolute. It's interesting, though, because his first wife got him there. His second wife, you know, was his equal.
Mm-hmm. But then,
in so many ways.
Right.
And then his third wife, I mean, you know, I hate to say she used him to, you know, advance her career.
But she did.
But she used him to advance her career.
Right. Hank, if I may interject, I just want to let our listeners know, if you're just joining us, that Hank Bordowitz is with us. Hank has written the definitive biography, and it's entitled Billy Joel, The Life and Times of an Angry Man.
And Angry Young Man.
Yes, Angry Young Man. And you see this throughout, the frustration and some of those feelings of inadequacy that he really has. And it seems and I'm trying to remember where in the book I read this, but where he was just so preoccupied with an interview about talking about just how many women he had been with.
Ah, yeah, my buddy Stuart.
Yes, that's it. Thank you.
Piano Today.
That's it.
I used to work with Stuart. We shared office space. And I got the book just around, you know, time, first one, and we were talking about that. And he says, you know, I interviewed him. He said, I got to do it just on the piano. It could only be about the fantasies and delusions. And then he's having lunch with Billy, and Billy's just talking about all his conquests.
Right. It was like he was just so one-track minded with that in the course of that interview.
Yeah. And I mean, even the way he describes, you know, coming to grips with classical music. And it's a description he used often, you know, was rock and roll, you know, classical music was the nice girl next door.
Mm-hmm.
And rock and roll was this, you know, floozy in fishnet stockings with, you know, heavy lipstick and leather dress. And, you know, he went out with that for 30 years. And, so, you know, in the meantime, the girl next door got hot.
Right.
And he uses that metaphor a lot.
Now, Billy had, he felt, didn't he feel as though he was saddled with a label as like a balladeer? He had problems with that?
He did. He had problems with that to the extent that he hired Howard Bloom.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that was what Howard was hired to, you know, A, kind of bring the press around to him, but also to convince people that he was a rock and roller. Billy's always thought of himself as that.
But could
you? I mean, you know.
Right.
The Beatles did Michelle, but nobody ever, you know, used that to blot out Twist and Shout.
Exactly. You mentioned you rattled off some of those Beatle tunes, and it's like, hey, nobody held it against them for some of those lightweight songs at the beginning. But what about just the way you are? In your book, you mentioned that things got a little tense in the studio, specifically with his drummer.
Well, yeah. Lib hated that song, especially the original
way
it was.
You're referring to Liberty DeVito, the drummer, right?
Yes, Liberty DeVito. Mm-hmm. Liberty hated that song, especially the original way. It was a kind of a cha-cha.
Cha-cha.
And it's true. You know, and this is one of the things that happen when you have a band. You know, he says, I'm not going to play this greasy Desi Arnaz stuff. You know, I'm a rock and roll drummer.
Right. In fact, didn't he say something, Hank, about, hey, I'm not Tito Puente?
Something of that nature.
So, I'm not going to play that oily cocktail lounge cha-cha-cha samba crap or something
and
like that.
There's a great video on YouTube of Billy during the rock and roll, the Songwriters Hall of Fame, talking about Phil Ramone and how, you know, this stuff evolved in the studio. And he plays that version, the cha-cha version of Just the Way You Are. And he says, hey, to the drummer, he says, hey, play me, well, I'm not going to use the word, the adjective he used, play me a crummy cha-cha beat. And he played that version of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, things evolved in the studio, and that was a lot of that had to do with Phil Ramone.
Right.
And the fact that he was working with a band that felt like they could give him that kind of input.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned about how grueling the touring can be, especially somebody like a Billy Joel that's capable of selling out one venue after another. But you know what I found interesting in your book? You mentioned that that, you know, when some of these other artists, I think The Who comes to mind, the tickets were going for $350. At the same time, here's Billy Joel selling tickets for $89. And did he have that much control over it? Was this something that he was mandating, that he wanted to make his concerts accessible to the average guy?
Yeah, bands can exert that kind of control. Billy did that, and Dennis Arfa was happy to do it.
So he said, in other words, he told the concert promoters, listen, the top price I want for my tickets, the top seats, are only going to be $89.
Yeah, are you familiar with a group called Incubus?
Mm-hmm.
They sell out, you know, arenas regularly. And their top price, I think, is now $35. It used to be $25. And
well, that's
if you're
refreshing.
Them,
you
and if you're going to have them play, you know, at your venue, if you're producing the show, you're going to have to figure out how to make a profit from that.
Well, I find that very refreshing.
You know, it's because, you know, it's doing it for the fans.
No,
and, you know, that's one of the things that he, you know, Billy Joel fans are intensely loyal, even though some of them regard it as a guilty pleasure. But, you know, that's one of the reasons they are.
Well, I think it builds allegiance, too.
Yeah.
Amongst
absolutely.
Fans. You know, speaking of touring, Jerry Schilling seems like a very interesting fellow. And
he
was Joel's road manager for a spell. Is this the same Schilling that went on to work with the Beach Boys?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Right after Joel.
Oh, was it after that?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, I think it was after.
Right. And I found it kind of humorous. If you could just share real quickly that that final
date
in
story?
Sydney, Australia, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so it's the last day of this world tour. They've been on the road forever.
Yeah, it's a grueling tour.
So Jerry decides, hey, I may never get to this side of the world again, and he's going to do, you know, the grand tour of the South Pacific. So he goes to the American embassy and they tell him what he has to do. He gets all his shots and he comes down with a mild case of, cholera, basically. And he's running 103 fever the last night of the show and he can't make the show. He's up in his room hallucinating. I mean, he's just in really rough shape. And around 11:30.
Yeah, he's got a high fever, right?
He's got 104 fever. And at about 11:30, his phone rings, and he picks it up, and they said, one of the guys on the crew says, listen, you got to come down here real, I mean, immediately. Billy's in jail in Sydney. There was some disturbance backstage, and, you know, he got into a fist fight with a local. And Billy goes, you know, and Jerry curses and says, all right, be right there. Gets up. His shirt is misbuttoned. He has two different socks on, two different kinds of color socks. His trousers are filthy. He just picked up the closest clothes he could. And he gets down to the elevator. He's sweating and his hair is standing up and he's looking a wreck. And he gets down to the first floor of the hotel and there's the band singing Volare to him. And it was all a joke.
Yeah. But you know what? He has said some very, very fond things about working with Billy Joel on the road, hasn't he?
Yeah. And yeah, he said almost everything, you know, like I said, almost everyone I talked to had nothing bad to say about him.
Let's talk a little bit, though, about what Elton John has said recently.
Even Elton says that affectionately, by the way.
Right. I think there's true concern on the part of Elton John for his friend Billy Joel.
I think so, too. And Elton's been there, done that. Several times.
What I'm referring to is, and I think most of our listeners know about it.
Elton has a problem, as Rush put it, a problem with his poisons.
Right.
Particularly, Elton was drinking cocaine, and Billy, you know, is that drunk that must have his drink.
And Elton has said that he needs to get away from wimpy rehab and take this thing seriously, right?
Yeah, and the problem is Billy doesn't really think he has a problem. I mean, he went to Betty Ford.
Yeah,
the stuff he says about Betty Ford is hysterical.
Right. I think in your book you mentioned he refers to it like a concentration camp, right?
Yeah, he says that they're Nazis.
Yeah. But maybe that's exactly what he needs as a Betty Ford.
Well, he spent close to a month there. And I think 2006.
Now, didn't he also seek treatment at Silver Hill Hospital?
Before that, and when he was wrapping cars around trees and into houses.
Right. But after that, in your book, you say that when he went back on the road, Elton John's dressing room was loaded with booze, but all you could find in Billy Joel's dressing room was coffee.
Mm-hmm. He spent a lot of time with Elton's band, I think. No, and for a lot of that time, there's only one thing worse than reformed alcoholic, and that's relapsed alcoholic.
Mm-hmm. Which, it's, you know, when you're touring and you're away from home and everything is flowing, everything, it's got to be awfully tough, awfully tough.
And you know what? I was at a music business conference, I guess it was in January, and they had meetings for the friends of Bill every day.
Really?
Twice a day. Mm-hmm. Because there was a lot of drinking going on there.
But, you know, in the book you mentioned after he got out of rehab, they were in Chicago. They went to Spiaggia, which, incidentally, Tony Montuano, the chef and part owner, has been on our show. And Billy Joel asked him to keep the restaurant open for his party. Picked up a $2,000 tab, and everybody was feasting on wine and cheese, but not Billy, right?
That's what said.
He didn't drink.
That's what they said. So there was a period where he didn't, and actually he still maintains that all he might have is a glass of wine now and again. You know, so.
But I get the feeling, Hank, that Elton isn't buying that.
Well, there was an evening at the Meadowlands, which is I can see them from where I am right now, where they did their show, and Billy was just not well, and he claimed that he had the flu, and Elton claimed that he was drunk off his ass. Excuse me, I'm on the radio. Well,
the A word's okay.
I hope Maria caught that.
Maria, she's got her finger on the button, but you're okay on that one.
Okay.
We'll let that one go, especially since it's Hank Bordowitz.
Well, I'm trying to mind my manners here.
Right. But Hank, I think, you know, Elton John, it takes one to know one or see one. And I think Elton, you know, you're not going to be able to BS Elton.
That's true.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to note that Elton, in the time since Billy's most recent marriage has collapsed, has become the picture of domesticity.
Interesting. That's an interesting way of putting it. So what do you think? I mean, do you think that Billy Joel has a guardian angel? I'm not talking Curtis Sliwa here. I'm talking about, do you think he has?
I spent some time living not too long ago in Illinois. Nobody knew what a Curtis Sliwa was.
Really?
Yeah.
Come on. I mean, that Red Beret?
I know Curtis. I've met Curtis.
Uh-huh.
But I mentioned him, you know, I mentioned the guardian angels, and they said, who?
Really? Yeah. In Chicago for a while there was a guardian angel presence, I would say, about 15,
yes.
20 years ago.
And there was one in Wisconsin, actually, during all the unpleasantness with your governor.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah. Curtis, I think Simpson spoke up there.
You know what? You're a veritable wealth of information. You know that? But seriously, does this guy have a guardian angel? Because, you know, there's a lot of rock stars that have fallen hard from privilege and excess, and this guy seems to have like 9 lives.
I don't know what it is. You know, maybe he does.
You know, I even
if he has a guardian angel, it's an angel with a very strange sense of humor.
Yeah. I mean, there was a half-hearted suicide attempt many years ago back when he was with Elizabeth. And I found that hilarious because what did he swallow? Furniture polish?
It was furniture polish. It was either that or bleach, and furniture polish looked more tasty.
Yeah, and he's in the hospital in the mental ward, and he's calling his friends and saying, "You got to get me out of here." And he said, what did he say? I'm passing. All I'm doing is passing.
Yes, he was passing lemon oil.
Lemon oil. Yes. I mean, was that? Do you think that was just a half-hearted call for help or attention at that point?
I think it probably was, and he got the attention certainly from Elliot.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
That's a great. The story of how they got him out is just hysterical.
That is.
You know, Elliot went to the hospital, and he was a dental student at the time. He gave up his dental student, you know, his dental school to manage Billy Joel. But he still had his lab coat. So he walks in there with a lab coat and a briefcase and puts his arm around Billy, and they walk out of the hospital together.
I loved it. I just loved it. What about Alexa, Billy and Christie's daughter? Now, there was an accidental overdose there. Isn't that around right at Christmas time? Wasn't that?
It's, the only person who knows that right now is Alexa.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
she ain't telling.
She's rebounded well from that. I mean, there was a failed relationship that transpired at that same time, right?
Mm-hmm. That's what the cause was,
mm-hmm.
theoretically.
But outwardly, does it look like things are okay with her? She seems to be doing pretty well, right?
Outwardly, things look very good for her. And, her music... It's a shame that she's Billy Joel's daughter because people would take her music a lot more seriously if she wasn't.
So in her case, that notoriety, that fame can work against you. But you know what?
Yeah, it's worked against a lot of rock stars'
right.
kids.
But you know, we touched on it before. I mean, she is blessed with. I mean, things may be a little dysfunctional, but there does truly appear that reading your book that she has two very loving parents.
Oh yeah, they're so devoted to her, and she realizes it. She knows this, which is more than you can say about a lot of kids,
right? You know, Hank, did I tell you how much I liked your book?
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I really feel like I kind of understand Billy Joel now. I mean, I feel like he could have been laying on my couch, and I could have been giving him therapy. And I find it extremely, extremely interesting what you said, though, about the fact that you wouldn't be the least bit surprised if someday he and Christy end up together again.
I would not be the least bit surprised.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So where do we go from here? Can we...
Want to talk about the other book?
I wholeheartedly recommend this book to our listeners. If you are a fan or you enjoy his music, you're really going to enjoy this book. But I got to ask you, what is going on with the record industry?
Lord. There is no such thing anymore. It's become the recorded content industry. And this may not be a bad thing. Understand, people are saying that the record industry is dying, it's dead, but it's still, you're still selling, 6-7 billion CDs, and certainly it's down from 12 billion.
Right.
But this has happened before. During the Depression, they, went from selling, it was not billions, it was millions of glass and lacquer singles to selling, thousands of them.
Mm-hmm.
And people were saying, well, the record industry will never come back. And then, just during World War II, everything was, phenomenal. They were selling more than ever.
But,
does work in cycles.
Right. But you know what, Hank, I find this interesting. You look at some of those top grossing tours out there, and it's the guys from the 70s and 80s. That seemed to be dominant. The artists from that era sold all these albums before the internet was decimating things. Is that my imagination, or is that the case?
Well, I mean, you have tours from Lady Gaga,
right,
Justin Bieber, and they're doing very well.
Right, but you.
A lot of that is, heritage acts.
Thank you.
Legacy
I was looking
acts.
For the word heritage acts. That's a good way of describing it.
I really explore this in depth in a book called Dirty Little Secrets of the Record Business.
Now, when did that book come out?
It came out in 2007.
I'm going to have to.
And standing up surprisingly well.
Well.
Considering all the changes, it's standing up well.
You know, Hank, unfortunately, I've just been cued by my producer. I didn't realize how late it is. We're bumping up against our final commercial break in the network news. And this is the true sign of a great guest. The hour literally flew. I want to thank you so much. And once again, congratulations on the latest reincarnation of your book, Billy Joel, The Life and Times of an Angry Young Man. Do you think we could have you back again sometime?
Absolutely. Anytime you want.
You're a great guest. Thank you so much, and thank you for taking time out of your busy day. Have a good one.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.